I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Call me Snake.
With blackest eyes, the devil's eyes. Purely and simply evil.
You're out of your mind,
Wang. God bless you.
What do we do?
Hello out there, and welcome back to Precinct 13, a podcast about the movies, music, and mind of John Carpenter. My name is Nick Rocco Scalia, one of your two co-hosts, joined as always by your other co-host, Chris Oliphant. Hey, Chris.
Hey, how are you doing, Nick?
I'm good, although it doesn't really matter about me anymore. My happiness and well-being is secondary to someone else's as of about a week ago at this point.
Yep. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I cannot believe the timing of it. It's also our friend Brian. You guys are both dads now.
Yeah. Since the last time we did a show, actually, neither one of us had a kid, and now we both have kids. And with correct social distancing in place, we've actually, they've met each other at this point, sort of. Not that either one of them can tell what's going on because they're like a week old.
Well, congratulations. That's obviously a pretty life-changing event. But anyway, let's talk about Big Trouble, Little China.
Yeah, of course. Let's talk about movies again. Actually, as we were just talking about before we started recording, I just watched this movie a couple days ago, and she was in the room the whole time. She slept through it, but I'm hoping maybe she got a little bit of the John Carpenter through osmosis, and that was kind of sort of her first movie experience. So a good one to start off on.
Wow, that is awesome. I couldn't have recommended a better film to start off your cinema viewing experience in life.
Well, I would have thought The Thing, but, you know, you take what you can get, really, and that's just sort of where we're at with the show. But, yeah, we're talking about 1986's Big Trouble in Little China, a film that I have to confess something to you, Chris. I've never seen this movie in its entirety before. It was one of those things where I had seen bits and pieces of it on television so much when I was a little kid, because it just seemed to be on all the time, that it was just like, oh yeah, I've seen Big Trouble in Little China. I know all about Jack Burton and David Lopan and this whole situation happening. Not that I can still explain it to this day, but like, if you had asked me, yeah, I would have said, I've seen that movie. I know what that movie is all about. I remembered some of the wisecracks and stuff like that. But seeing it this time, I realized that I don't think I'd ever watched it front to back. I don't think I'd ever seen an unedited version. It is a PG-13 movie, although you could get away with a lot with a PG-13 back in the 80s. So this was kind of a really fascinating experience for me. It was like revisiting something that I don't know that I ever actually visited in the first place. What is your history with Big Trouble in Little China?
It's funny because I remember growing up, actually a mutual friend of ours, Tim Tiska, basically used to watch this movie all the time. And this was probably back in, I want to say, this was probably back in like the mid-2000s or somewhere in that time period. And I never watched it with him, but kind of the same as you, I would always like, you know, catch bits and pieces of it here and there. And then I think I saw Big Trouble in Little China for the first time in its entirety about maybe 5 years ago. And at this point, I've probably seen it a half a dozen times all the way through, especially, you know, with my interest in John Carpenter getting so much bigger in the last couple of years. I've watched it quite a few times. I have this on Blu-ray. And dang it all, I just know. Did you see that ridiculous limited edition like box set they released for this thing?
For just this movie?
Yeah. It comes with like the vinyl and posters and this whole Pork Chop Express thing. It's pretty impressive.
But... And you have that on pre-order, I'm assuming.
No, I do not actually. I do have the vinyl though. It's a dual LP. Wonderful soundtrack and the Blu-ray as well. If I didn't already have those two things, I would have absolutely ordered it. On a side note, how cool is that they are re-releasing The Thing on vinyl with the bonus Carpenter record. Did you see that?
Yeah, and I think it's really fascinating because, you know, we finished talking about that movie a couple of months ago, and it's been on my mind a lot, and you and I were just talking about scores, and we just did an episode on lost themes and all that, and literally, I mean, it's been all over everything. I think I mentioned when we talked about lost themes, one of the places I learned about that album years ago was on Pitchfork, and they covered this too. So it's like John Carpenter has really established himself as kind of an artist that the indie music world pays attention to, which I don't know was true a while ago. And I know he's been making music for a long time, but these releases are starting to get like a lot of press coverage, which is cool.
Yep. And I definitely pre-ordered that. And I think those ship like May 5th or May 6th or something. And that was one that was missing from my collection. So I'm super excited about that. But then it comes with like a whole bonus record as well of just unreleased material that, I don't know. I guess they conjured up some new stuff inspired by the thing. I mean, I can't wait to hear it. But the website that I purchased it from, I went back to it the next day and like everything was sold out. So I was really grateful that a friend of mine, Josh Mosley, thank you very much, tipped me off and sent me the text that morning. And he's like, dude, I know you want this. And I was like, all right, fine. Yeah. So, you know, but yeah, so Big Trouble, man. I, you know, basically am pretty familiar with the movie at this point, having seen it about six times.
See, I'm not. And this movie is such a fever dream. Like, I watched it. I was there. You know, I was much more conscious than my daughter was. But I have so many questions. I have so many thoughts. So we're going to do two episodes on this one. I think this is a big enough sort of milestone in the Carpenter canon and a movie that's just beloved and talked about enough where it's probably worth doing the two episode treatment. I mean, there's a lot of movies that we haven't done that for that we maybe should have. But this is one that I really think we need to spend the extra time on. So we will be right back and kick off our discussion of Big Trouble in Little China.
They call it Little China.
Finally, we shall bring order out of chaos.
It's where Big Trouble was waiting for Jack Burton.
Who?
Jack Burton. Me.
Jack.
Jack.
Jack!
They told him to go to hell.
You make one move.
And that's just where he's going.
All right, we are back, ready to kick off our discussion of Big Trouble in Little China, Carpenter's follow-up to the 1984 film Starman, which is a very, very different movie from this one, and I think this just really shows the versatility of him as a filmmaker. I mean, we went from this very sort of, I want to say sentimental and family-friendly Hollywood sci-fi romance to something that just encompasses so many things. I mean, it's basically, I want to say it's his first comedy since Dark Star, his first like all-out, flat-out sort of comedy. I've never really, I don't think there's much martial arts in any of his other movies leading up to this, right?
I don't think there's any. I can't think of any martial arts.
I mean, like fighting off Michael Myers, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, going down the list, is there any martial arts in Assault on Precinct 13? Maybe a little bit.
I mean, there's definitely fighting. There's hand-to-hand combat, but I wouldn't call any of it particularly graceful.
Right.
And we do get a lot of that wire work and just amazing sort of Hong Kong-style filmmaking here. And, oh, man, I'm just overwhelmed by all we have to talk about with this movie. But we probably should start just kind of pre-production stuff and how this movie came to be. Basically, like, I had no idea what the genesis of this was at all, because obviously this is not one that Carpenter wrote himself. It's not an original idea of his. This was, like Starman, something that he kind of signed on to later on. And this movie was originally supposed to be a Western set in the 1880s and would have done basically everything that the current film we see does, but rather than being in modern day San Francisco or 1986 San Francisco, it would have been set during the Gold Rush era. And I really would be interested in reading this script. So it was by two guys, Gary Goldman and David Weinstein, and basically the script was purchased by the studios in the early 80s, and you know, I've been reading a little bit about it, and it was literally like a mystical Western, and they were very interested in setting this in the Old West, and Jack Burton, rather than having a truck, he had a horse, and his horse is what goes missing and that he's going after. So obviously, you know, some ways of modernizing this were pretty obvious ones and others were not. But once again, like always happens in Hollywood, the producers who bought that script really liked the ideas and really hated the script. Carpenter, commenting on it later on, said the script was kind of a no-go and there was really no way they could have made it. So it did not get made the way it was originally intended. And W.D. Richter, who is a cult filmmaker in his own right, he was the one that was hired to basically do a page one rewrite on it and start over from scratch. Chris, do you know W.D. Richter is probably best known to movie audiences of our stripe as the director and writer of The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai in the Fourth Dimension, I believe it's called. And
wow.
I have never seen this movie, but I've been reading about it like my entire life. Have you seen Buckaroo Banzai?
I have not. I've never heard of it.
Yeah, it's like a sci-fi comedy, post-apocalyptic, I think there's time travel, stars Peter Weller, who of course would go on and be RoboCop, and I've just heard so many amazing things about this movie. It's like a real 80s cult classic that for some reason has just eluded me all this time. I guess you too?
Absolutely. I mean, I have never even had anyone mention it before.
Maybe we'll have to do a bonus episode on it because it does have the tangential sort of Carpenter connection with W.D. Richter. But anyway, he is the guy who ended up getting final credit. And I guess there were some disputes about who was getting the script writing credit for this movie. But Carpenter, I believe, was the only director ever attached to this project. So unlike a lot of other stuff that he had worked on or had been attached to up to this point, like The Thing, for example, he was not the first choice there. And a lot of times project kind of cycled through a lot of hands before they got to Carpenter's. Oddly enough, because he'd never really done anything quite like this before, he was the first guy that signed up and he was who they went with.
Yep. That's incredible, man. The genesis of movies, you know, it's like some movies are obviously passionate. I mean, look at what Carpenter did with his arrangement for Christine. You know, like that was just a job, basically.
Yeah.
And then you have other movies that are more passion projects, like your Assault on Precinct 13's The Thing, probably even to some extent The Fog. So this one has an even different genesis to it. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, this is a studio project. And basically what I've seen about Carpenter's comments on this were after Starman, which was a success and which was a very mainstream movie, he kind of wanted to keep working in the studio mold. And this is, I mean, budget. It's so hard to talk about budgets because this movie is older and you know, it's like inflation and things like that. I mean, movies just cost more to make now. But I mean, this is a massively budgeted movie for the time, just in the sense, I mean, maybe not even in terms of the dollars, but there's, I think, more extras in this movie than anything we've seen him do before, and just sort of much, much bigger set pieces. And whereas as every Carpenter movie up to this point is kind of a tension and release thing, like Assault and Precinct 13, where we've got a lot of talk and a lot of backstory and a lot of character interaction going on between action sequences. I mean, there's not that many action sequences in that movie, which of course is true of many low budget sort of exploitation era movies. But this one just kind of starts going about 20 minutes in and it does not let up at all until the end. It's just a rock'em sock'em stuff happening at all times kind of movie, and lots of different sets and lots of production design that looks very elaborate. So, you know, obviously this is him working in that very high level kind of way and in a very large scale sort of sense.
Yeah, the easiest way I would describe this movie to people that may have seen some John Carpenter movies, but not all of them, and in particularly haven't seen this one. It's just like, look, this is by far his most fun movie, and it's a straight up action adventure comedy with a shitload of martial arts in it and just like crazy awesome score, like just a very bizarre score, because it's kind of like he does his normal, you know, synthesized sound, but then he's like, he's implementing this kind of like Asian flair to it, you know, and like, so a lot of the instrumentation is crazy. And yeah, like you said, I mean, this might be his most colorful picture as well, just as far as like the pastels and the set pieces, as you were mentioning. It's just a kind of a cool movie to look at. But it is wacky, man. No question about it. And I think that that's probably part of the reason why, you know, this movie maybe didn't do so well is because no one really knew how to market it. I think people maybe thought when they saw the poster for it, they were going to get this like Indiana Jones kind of movie. And instead, they get Jack Burton and the Pork Chop Express. So it's just a really unique movie.
Yeah, it is. Although you mentioned Indiana Jones, and an episode or two ago, we were just talking about Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, which came out in 84. And as far as comparing this movie to something, it reminds me a lot of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, where you have kind of a one location kind of story. And Jack Burton and Indiana Jones himself, I think there are some similarities there. They're sort of these jut-jawed, wisecracking heroes. Burton is very different from Indiana Jones in a couple of key ways that we need to talk about, but reminds me a little bit of that. It's a little slapsticky. I mean, if you look at Temple of Doom today,
oh, yeah,
and particularly compared to some of the other Indiana Jones movies, they do go pretty hard for the comedy in a lot of that. And this one, I mean, I would describe this more as a comedy than anything else, or an action comedy, which is, you know, we've seen a lot of those Hong Kong movies, which do sort of combine slapstick and stunts in a really interesting way. So yes, they are action movies in the sense that there's fight scenes happening left and right, but they are also, you know, they kind of go back to the silent movie tradition, the Buster Keaton stuff, where, you know, physical comedy is kind of, and the way you film physical comedy and how you get these sort of slapsticky sight gags into your movies, you see a lot of that in the martial arts genre also. And I think that was a thing Carpenter was just interested in trying. Like in what I've read, he says, I wanted to do a martial arts movie. So this was an opportunity to do that. Another film that I have to ask you about, because it does kind of have some bearing on this one, is Eddie Murphy's The Golden Child, or Eddie Murphy starring in The Golden Child, which is a movie that I saw once as a kid that I absolutely did watch front to back, and I remember literally nothing about it. Do you remember that movie?
No, I've never seen that. Is it good?
When I was like 6 years old, I thought it was. But
so probably not.
So probably not. Yeah. Looking back on it, it looks like it was kind of a flop and a failure. And basically what it is, I mean, it's a very similar story as I remember it to Big Trouble in Little China, where Eddie Murphy, you know, kind of at the height of his popularity on SNL and Beverly Hills Cop and those great 48 Hours, you know, 80s Eddie Murphy comedies. They gave him this huge budget thing, which was more of an adventure movie. He's protecting a kid, literally the golden child. And I don't remember from who or what about, but there was some kind of like mystical, magical element to it. And it was an action film, and it was kind of goofy and over the top. And basically, Big Trouble in Little China was kind of rushed into production to get out ahead of that, because at the time, like I was saying, Eddie Murphy was a huge, huge star, and they were anticipating that movie to be a gigantic hit. And I don't think it was. I remember seeing it a lot in the video store, but I don't remember it being this sort of massive success. Oh, you haven't seen it, so maybe that says something right there. But actually, from what I've been reading, that film was offered to Carpenter, like while it almost sounds like it was while he was already attached to this one. And he said, no, this
oh, really?
One's my baby. So we're going to get ours out first, and ours is going to be better. And, you know, just looking at this one now and thinking back to that other one, I think he was right there. I think he made the correct choice.
Definitely. I think there's a lot of stuff that I haven't seen with Eddie Murphy, to be honest with you. I've always thought of when, you know, I think the first thing I think of is either Beverly Hills Cop or like Coming to America.
Great one.
But yeah, I have not seen a lot of Eddie Murphy stuff. I mean, I've seen Trading Places, but yeah. So anyhow, back to Big Trouble. One thing I wanted to point out is I was reading here that, so Dennis Dunn is in this movie.
Yes.
And you're going to see him again in Prince of Darkness, actually. And I guess Carpenter, I'd say part of his inspiration for making a martial arts movie was seeing Dennis Dunn in the movie Year of the Dragon, which I'm looking at. There's so many movies I have to watch. It's ridiculous.
Have you seen that one? Because I've always wanted to see that movie, too. That's the Mickey Rourke movie, correct?
Oh, I have seen this. Yeah, this is a Oliver Stone screenplay, actually. Yep, I have seen this.
And I believe it's, isn't it Mickey Rourke, and he's a cop in, I think it's Chinatown, actually, and he's dealing with gang warfare or something like that?
I remember him being great in it. I remember this movie being, like, really entertaining. But, see, that's the thing, is I wasn't really paying attention to Dennis Dunn at that point, but apparently he is in this.
I was looking at this movie, and there's so many people in this movie who I've seen before. I mean, there's some really great character actors. Like, I just have the cast list here because I don't want to forget to talk about anyone. But also, you have a few actors in this movie who didn't do a lot of other stuff, and Dennis Dunn was definitely one of them. And I think Wang is an amazing character, and he's kind of the hero of this movie and really has a lot of screen presence and a lot of charisma, and I love his comedic timing, and he's really, really cool in the fight scenes also. And so, you know, you would think something like this would just have launched him into the stratosphere, and totally didn't. You know, just looking at his credits, he hasn't done a lot more. He did work with Carpenter again, like you said, so that's cool. I mean, obviously that was a good working relationship there, but yeah, I was interested. I mean, I thought maybe I just didn't know he was in other stuff. Maybe he changed his look or something like that, but nope, he kind of never really had a huge Hollywood career.
That's interesting, because he is very good in this movie, and yeah, he ends up whipping a lot of ass and making Jack Burton look like kind of a like a bumbling idiot at times. But Kim Cattrall too, who is very awesome in this movie.
Yeah, of course, star of Mannequin, movie that I definitely watched a lot when I was a kid, and we know her as she's Samantha on Sex and the City.
I wouldn't know.
I'm asking you like you would know. I've seen more of that show than I'd like to admit to. I thought we'd kick off our discussion. I mean, I kind of want to go like step by step with this movie, with the plot. I mean, it doesn't have a complicated story, but it has a lot of story, and it has a really complicated backstory. And then certain other things are kind of left to the side. Let me just flat out, can I lay my cards on the table about this movie?
I cannot wait to hear your opinion.
We're going to start with it, I think. So I enjoyed okay. the shit out of this movie. I loved every second yep. of it that it was on, but I felt like there were a lot of things about it that were just kind of missing. It felt like it moved so fast, and it did so much, and it went by in such a blur. Like, I think I described it earlier as a fever dream, and that is kind of what it is to me. Like, I couldn't hold on to anything as long as I kind of wanted to in this movie, and I really liked the characters, but I felt like there wasn't a lot of character development in it. And so I can't find the love for this that I do for something like Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, which has just sort of really iconic character moments to me. And, you know, it might also be nostalgia because I did grow up with that movie. But I wanted to start with Roger Ebert's review, actually, because he liked it a lot less than I did. I think it was a 2-star review, and he was very dismissive of it. And he made 3 criticisms of this movie, and I want to kind of address them as we talk about this movie, because I agree with some and I don't agree with the others. So Roger,
I love when we get into these Roger Ebert debates. This is just awesome.
Yeah, you know, I find myself disagreeing with him so much on Carpenter's movies, and I really like him, you know, normally.
Yeah, you're normally simpatico with most of his reviews, but I've noticed that as well, that he does not favor... Interestingly enough, he ends up giving Escape from L.A. a really good review.
Yeah, oddly, I think he gave it 3.5 stars, and he loved Halloween. I mean, he was a real early champion of Halloween, and of course it, mm-hmm. of course he was, because it's a great movie. But basically, Ebert's review boils down to 3 sort of major problems he had with the movie. He says the sequences are repetitive, so we see one type of sequence, and then we just sort of see it play out ad nauseum for the rest of the movie. That's one I really disagree with, and that's why I kind of want to talk about this movie step by step, because I think Carpenter actually does a really cool thing here in these action set pieces where he is always kind of building to something bigger and better and more surprising. There were a couple of moments in this movie that, not that they were scary, not that they were shocking, but I was like, holy shit, did that just happen? I mean, that was my feeling about maybe a half dozen times through this movie, and definitely seeing stuff that I must have not caught on my initial sort of fragmentary viewings of this movie. So one criticism he had was the repetition of it and the fact that a lot of these sequences play out kind of the same. He also said the character development was lacking and we don't get to know these characters well enough. And on that one, I think I agree with him very much. Particularly, I think characters like Wang are a little bit underserved. Like, for part of this movie, he's this sidekick almost, and then when it comes time for him to fight, he's amazing at martial arts and beats adversaries that should be 10 times more powerful and 10 times more skilled than him. And, you know, it's just little stuff like that where I'm like, oh, should we have known this about him? So I had some issues with the lack of character development and just the fact that this movie never takes a breath. Like, it just doesn't pause to give us, you know, some of those scenes like we talked about before, like with Assault in Precinct 13, where, you know, these adversarial characters get to know each other. You know, Austin Stoker and Darwin Jostin hanging out in the police station between action scenes and kind of hashing out who they are and what their philosophy and worldview is and becoming friends. That's one of the things I love the most about that movie. And there's a lot of friendship and loyalty and brotherhood in Big Trouble in Little China, but we never get a great sense of maybe how these relationships work. So that was another thing. And then finally, Ebert makes a point about stereotypes and the portrayal of Chinese culture in this movie. And he compares it to Fu Manchu and Charlie Chan, these sort of previous generations of Hollywood kind of film series about Chinese characters. And to be honest, I've never seen a Charlie Chan movie or short. I don't know much about Fu Manchu, except of course for the iconic beard. So I can't really see the comparison, but I definitely get his point that, you know, maybe some of the portrayals culturally in this movie are not the most sensitive or the most modern, you know, they might be a little bit regressive. But also, I have to disagree with that in the sense that a lot of Chinese American talent is in this movie. And I think it is ultimately kind of just respectful to the idea that Chinese culture goes back so much farther than American culture. And we're talking about thousands of years ago, and the mysticism of it I really like. And I think Carpenter seems to be kind of enamored with that also. You know, we don't get a lot of time to talk about that stuff in this movie, but it's better than a movie that just sort of uses it as window dressing. You know what I mean? Where like one character is maybe of Asian descent. There's lots of characters of Asian descent in this movie, and there's lots of history and sort of culture and design that kind of goes back to the Chinese tradition. So, you know, I agree that some of it is a little broad and a little stereotypical, but I also think there's some great stuff in this movie. And he employed how many Chinese American and Chinese actors in this movie? Like, you look down the cast list and there's very few Caucasian people in this movie. So that's my thoughts on Ebert. And I want to just kind of address those points, like I said, as we go on. But I think since we're laying our cards on the table and just getting it all right out there, Chris, what's your assessment of Big Trouble in Little China?
Oh, I love this movie. I actually just in this last viewing, oh man, I was going to see, I just may have gone down a rabbit hole here. Are you on Letterboxd?
I am, but I'm not keeping up with it very good. I watch a lot more movies than I list on Letterboxd, and I shouldn't. I want to keep up.
Yeah, I only write, I don't like log every movie I watch, but movies that I feel compelled to log, review, and catalog, I do. And I just did this one the other day, and I can tell you, I can read to you my paragraph review here. I gave it 4 stars out of 5. And I just said, as a fan of John Carpenter, I can say that this movie is not only his most fun picture, but his closest to a straightforward action adventure. It's packed with comedy, martial arts, and crazy set pieces. The score is wild, complex, and cleverly applied. Great casting and many entertaining fight sequences. Big Trouble also has great replay value and is so over the top with weirdness and costumes, it's just interesting to look at. Sure, it's got some cheese, but ultimately Kurt Russell is just a joy to watch as Jack Burton. What an awesome character. That's how I feel about it.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with just about everything there. And you mentioned like replay value and rewatchability. I want to see this movie like 100 more times.
It's so much fun. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It moves very fast. I mean, it's one of the paciest movies I've ever seen. I mean, you can just watch a 2-minute sequence and get so many amazing different things in that 2-minute sequence. I mean, you could just chop out any part of this movie and you're going to get some action and you're going to get some entertainment value there. And there is just so much going on in it. So I 100% agree with you on that. I don't know. I just kind of, I guess, wish it slowed down a little bit more. But I think that might be a good place to start, because one of the slowest and oddest scenes in the movie is the first one. So we open up with this weird sort of courtroom scene, and reading a little bit about the backstory of this movie, this was tacked on later on. This was at the request of the producers, but the Egg Shen character, played by Victor Wong, who is a really great actor and is a huge part of this movie, this amazing character actor that we've seen in hundreds of things. Some of my quarantine viewing in recent weeks, one of the things that I really enjoyed was the movie Tremors, which I hadn't seen in a very, very long time.
Ah, yes. Yeah, I forgot he was in that.
Yeah, he's really great in that movie. I'm always really sad when he dies in that movie. Spoiler alert for those who haven't seen this now 30-something-year-old movie. But yeah, he's a really fun sort of comedic actor. He has a great presence about him also. But we start out with this scene that is so different from the rest of the movie. I mean, it's kind of funny in a way. Like, we start with this very sober kind of courtroom scene where he's being grilled by his lawyer. He's in some kind of trouble. It's a flash forward. So after all the events of this movie have taken place, and he's talking about Jack Burton and why Jack Burton is a hero and Jack Burton should be respected, essentially, and not prosecuted. So that was the reason why they added this scene on, basically, was because Jack Burton's a very different kind of hero, I think, than most American audiences are used to. And he's a little bit more bumbling and a little bit more fallible than, say, an Indiana Jones or a 007 or something like that. So it's almost like the producers thought people are going to be too stupid to understand that. So we have to put this thing in here that says, no, trust us, he's the hero. So there's that. But the other thing that's interesting about this scene is he does a little bit of magic at the end of it. So he kind of introduces the mysticism and the magic and the history and the culture so that we're a little bit more prepared for that. Whereas Carpenter, you know, reading some of his interviews about this, what he basically says is, I wanted to really start out in a very normal sort of understandable modern world and then gradually go further and further back into that. And so this sort of undercuts that, because we see him, you know, it's a little bit of magic. He shoots some sparks between his fingers, a little electricity, sort of post-production electricity shooting back and forth between his hands. And there's a line about a building erupting in green fire and stuff like that. And I don't know. I mean, I don't think it helps this movie for us to know that there's going to be magical green fire and people shooting sparks out of their hands like Mortal Kombat style. We'll have to talk about that also, because this movie's a direct influence on Mortal Kombat, on the Raiden character. But I don't know. You tell me. Tell me what you think of that scene. What is this a good way to start this movie, or does it kind of lead us down a path we don't necessarily need to be led down?
I honestly don't think it's that effective of a scene. Like, I always forget that that's where this movie starts.
Yes.
And it's, you know, it's funny to see Jack Burton being defended so hard. You know, like, he's a hero. Like, stop giving him such a hard time. And, you know, things like that. And then, of course, as you mentioned, like the little post-production special effect there to show that there's going to be magic in this movie. But it doesn't, at the same time, it doesn't really diminish what's to come in the movie for me that much. But we probably could have started with just Jack Burton in the Pork Chop Express.
Well, that's what Carpenter wanted to do.
Yeah.
I think he actually overstates his case about Jack Burton as a hero.
Yeah.
He's pushing it a little farther than maybe it needs to go. But yeah, I mean, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, because obviously in this movie, I mean, Jack Burton's character is a man of many faults, and you're right. He absolutely does oversell him here at the beginning.
And that's what we like about Jack Burton. And I think we get that very quickly in the next scene, that, you know, he's established very quickly in the next scene as just not your average American movie hero. We're used to wisecracking characters like all of our favorite action heroes, John McClane or whatever. They know how to sling a one-liner back and forth. But Jack Burton really takes that to the next level. And a lot of his one-liners, I think, are like by choice, not all that funny. You know, like, they could have probably gotten somebody to punch up the dialogue and make him wittier than he is, but his one-liners are a little dopey. They're like dad jokes almost, which, you know, me being a dad now, I'm more appreciative of dad jokes than ever. But I think there's this conscious choice to make Jack Burton kind of silly and kind of not the wittiest character, and to make him more of an everyman and kind of a lunkhead. And we see that right away in this great opening sequence in the Pork Chop Express. He drives a truck called the Pork Chop Express. So that tells you a lot about him right there.
I'm reading this here. I cannot picture this at all. I guess Carpenter wanted a big star of his own, and both Clint Eastwood and Jack Nicholson we're considered, but we're busy. Can you picture either one of those people playing Jack Burton? I mean, can you picture Clint Eastwood or Jack Nicholson saying, like, it's all in the reflexes or something like that? Like, I just cannot picture that at all.
You know, not Clint Eastwood that most people are familiar with, but he did do a bunch of comedies. Like, I've never seen those monkey movies he did, Every Which Way But Loose, I think it's called, where he's like, it's a buddy comedy with him and an orangutan or some kind of monkey. And, like, I think part of the reason those movies exist, right, is to show this very gruff sort of actor in a silly kind of way. So maybe he could have handled it. And, you know, Jack Nicholson definitely not, right? Because although Jack Nicholson can be really funny, it's more of a sardonic, witty, kind of smarter than you kind of humor. Like, I'm thinking of him in, like, As Good As It Gets or something like that, or even Anger Management. So, I mean, Jack Nicholson's brilliant. He probably could have done it, but I don't know. I never really saw him as this kind of action hero either. Kurt Russell looks great in this movie. Like, he really, he got pretty bulked up for this one, I feel like.
Yeah, I read that he was, like, running and lifting weights for a couple months beforehand, and I guess at the same time, it's just really hard to imagine anybody else playing this role.
No, he's a lot of fun in this, and we'll get to a couple of parts in the early going of this movie where he really gets to have some fun with this character and do some really interesting stuff. But yeah, we meet him driving his big rig and kind of on his CB radio just extolling wisdom to whoever is listening. And I don't know, I'm watching the scene and I'm kind of imagining that nobody's listening. Like, you know, he's broadcasting to all the other truckers on his CB radio, but, like, they've probably all tuned him out at this point because all he does is, like, give him these aphorisms, whatever. I mean, they're pretty funny, but I don't know. I think I would get pretty tired of that pretty quickly if I was driving all night having to listen to his bullshit all the time.
I know. I love that scene, and I love how he's just, like, eating this huge hoagie, like, while he's driving.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and then we get into Chinatown, and he's up all night gambling, and is the winner of this gamble. I love that scene where Wang tries to cut the bottle in half and, you know, doesn't do it successfully. So basically Wang loses this bet and has to give him a bunch of money, and Jack's like, I'm following you because I don't trust you, sort of thing. And he's like, well, Wang's like, that's fine, but first we got to go to the airport and pick up my fiance.
Yeah, and it's just like plot, 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 plot. Like, we get these kind of scenes. I mean, the gambling scene is really fun, and one of the places where the movie really slows down a little bit to just let us get to know these characters is what you were just talking about, the thing with the bottle, you know, cut this bottle in half and this bet that gets placed there. And we get to see, I mean, I think they're better friends than that scene lets on, because just watching this now, I was like, it's a little hard to tell that these guys even know each other. I mean, they seem to have lots of history and this great relationship, and they're almost like antagonistic. Like, you almost read Wang in that scene as like a trickster character that's just trying to screw Jack over and get away from him or something like that, which I guess he kind of is, but he turns out to be kind of the moral center of the movie. He turns out to be the hero of the movie, and maybe it is a bait and switch, right? Maybe Carpenter and W.D. Richter, the screenwriter, kind of want us to think that, but it's a little inscrutable in this scene, like what he is going to be and what he's going to do. And then once they get to the airport to pick up his fiance, it's just like this movie just takes off like a freaking rocket.
Yeah, you know what else makes this movie great, before I forget, and I know you're going to agree with me wholeheartedly? Who's doing the cinematography here, buddy?
The great Dean Cundey. Carpenter, yes. Regular Dean Cundey. This movie looks incredible. I mean, I watched a very good print of it, and the colors in this movie just pop all over the place. You know, the sort of Chinatown iconography, and later in the movie, there's all this neon, which we have to talk. That'll probably be next episode, but oh man, there's some crazy neon that comes out of nowhere in this movie. But yeah, it is. It's extremely colorful. It's extremely well lit. They do a lot of interesting scenes even before they sort of go into the Lopan compound, whatever you want to call it, where they're in these various environments. They all just look amazing. The brothel and the restaurant, and, you know, all of the outdoor, the street scenes look really good. So yeah, it's good to have Dean Cundey back, and he does some really stellar work throughout this one.
Did he do Christine?
Put me on the spot, Chris. I don't know. Christine's a great looking movie too.
Hold on. I want to look this up because I want to see what he did last with Carpenter, because I'm pretty sure he didn't do Starman.
No, he did not do Starman.
Yeah, so we're looking at, he does Halloween in 78. He does The Fog in 80. Oh, he did Halloween 2 as, oh, he did Halloween 2 and 3. The Thing. Yeah, so he did not do Christine or Starman. So we haven't had Dean Cundey since The Thing.
Wow. Halloween 2 is a great looking movie also, just incidentally.
It is. I'm a big fan of that movie.
Yeah.
If you warts and all, I'm a big fan of that movie.
Me too. Your garish reds. I mean, I think it's a better movie to look at than to actually enjoy. But, oh, man, it's a tour de force of cinematography, at least as I remember. It's been a long time since I've seen it. But, yeah, this movie, right from the get-go, I mean, maybe not that courtroom scene so much, but right when we see Jack Burton in the truck for the first time, it's like, yeah, we're in for a real visual. I mean, it's a very poppy sort of comic booky kind of look that this movie has, and it definitely has a lot of comic booky sort of action and sort of over the top elements. So it's a perfect look. Even the poster of this movie is absolutely amazing. It's kind of this painted great sort of lots of characters on it. We get the Golden Gate Bridge in the background and Jack Burton looking all cool with that machine gun that's not really a machine gun because he only shoots like single shots with it. Anyway, it's definitely visually a really, really fascinating movie.
I couldn't agree more. So, should we talk about the airport scene?
Yeah, let's talk about the airport scene where the chaos in this movie really begins in so many different ways.
Yeah, I mean, they get to this airport, and at this point, Wang has shown Jack a picture of his fiance. He's there to pick her up, and then this is where we first see Kim Cattrall in the movie, and we get Jack Burton trying to put his Mac on a little bit.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't go well at all.
I love the romantic dialogue in this movie. It's very Howard Hawksian, and I'm sure that's by design. I'm sure Carpenter, being the Hawks fan that he is, I've read that a couple of times. And yeah, it's like this kind of antagonistic banter. One of the things that I find really funny about this movie is her character is a lawyer who's basically in the practice of defending Chinese Americans in Chinatown. So that's, I guess, all of her client base, and she's kind of fighting for the rights of immigrants. I mean, it's kind of an interesting character that she has that we don't really get to know much about. She's a very caring person, but we don't really know what kinds of stuff she does. But her name is Gracie Law, and she's a lawyer, which is basically about the same as calling her like Jennifer Attorney or something like that. So it's got to be just this. It's a very obvious choice, and it's kind of interesting. You know, it makes her a little bit one dimensional, at least in the name sense, which is kind of funny. I think it's not the movie being dumb. I think it's the movie being smart, actually.
Yeah, and out of nowhere comes a Chinese street gang, the Lords of Death.
Yes.
And basically, Wang's fiance is kidnapped. There's a pretty funny sequence here where, you know, Jack Burton tries to save the day, and he's completely unarmed, and this dude pulls out. What weapon does he pull out? It's not a sword. It's like, I don't know, something. And Kurt Russell just looks at him, and he's like, hey, where'd you get that? It's so funny.
There are a lot of really interesting bladed weapons in this movie, right? Like, this movie doesn't just have your standard swords, daggers, whatever. Like, you know, these spinning blade things that characters have. And, yeah, everybody's pulling out some weird-ass stainless steel, like, death blade contraption, like, at every point of this movie. Yeah, this is a very silent, filmy kind of sequence. I will say one reaction I had to this that you know, it's been so long since I've seen it. So Dennis Dunn pulls out the photograph of Wang's fiance. And even from the picture, I'm like, that is one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen in my life. And then she's, the actress's name is Susie Pai. And again, it's another actress who hadn't done a lot of other movies, and reading up on her, because I had to know more about her. She was a penthouse pet, I guess, in the early 80s, and used that modeling career to make her way somewhat into the movies. But she is absolutely stunning. Doesn't really have green eyes. Neither does Kim Cattrall. Those were contacts, which I hear, if you look really closely, I wasn't looking for this, but I hear the contacts are very obvious if you are paying attention. But yeah, I mean, just the casting of actresses in this movie, I mean, they're both just stunningly gorgeous. They have this great sort of very over-the-top Hollywood-y beauty about them. And yeah, I mean, just from seeing that one glimpse of her when he pulls out the photo, I was like, oh, wow, she's extremely attractive.
Right. And I completely agree with everything you just said there. But either way, they do successfully kidnap her, and then, you know, this chase begins, which leads to the really hilarious scene here.
Just one quick Carpenter connection in the scene before we move on. So they're in the parking garage of the airport. By the way, airport security in 1986
non-existent.
Was like a joke. They're just going in and out of doors. Nobody's paying attention. There's no security around. So very different time. But they end up in a parking garage and they're about to get run over by a car. And it's a really, really great stunt and a really, really well-cut sequence where it actually looks like they're going to get hit by this car. Like, films do that all the time. I mean, you see that so often, and it's usually so often obvious that it's either speeded up footage, and I think they did speed up the footage here. It's not like they didn't use the old tricks, but I was already like, oh wow, that looks really great. That's a really, really just well-cut sequence and well-acted and everything like that. And I'm thinking, oh, well, of course that's good. This is the guy who did Christine, and that's the best thing about that movie is when people look like they're going to get run over by cars, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. He has a little bit of experience in filming scenes like that. I love, too, how the camera cuts to her in the trunk of the car, too, for like 1 second. And it's just like a really cool, it's like really cool how it's added in there. But yeah, and here is where the movie just really kind of gets into its first real action scene when Jack pulls his truck into this alley and there's like this huge, like basically these groups, different groups like rivaling in the streets as they just like sit there in the truck and watch everything unfold. And it's just so hilarious. I mean,
yeah, they're so passive for this first action scene. I mean, all the airport stuff, of course, they do. And then they're just kind of spectators. They're very much audience surrogates where it's like there's this massive gang battle happening all around them. What I like about this scene, and we've kind of talked about this a little bit already, is that if you didn't know that this was going to be magic and mysticism and sorcery and 2,000-year-old demons and stuff like that, this could just be like your standard martial arts movie, right? You got these rival groups. They're kicking and punching and throwing each other, and it's all cut really well, and the sound design in this movie is great. Like, you feel the punches. Like, it's a chop socky sort of style, but it works really well. Like, it's not sort of that fakey American version of that, but it seems like they got really good stunt coordinators and fight choreographers, and this scene is fascinating even before all hell breaks loose sort of magically. But I'm watching it and I'm thinking, if I didn't know better, this could just be any other action movie. You know, it could be a Jackie Chan flick or something like that, where it's just martial arts and that's sort of what the spectacle of it is. And then it sort of ups the spectacle quantity quite a lot just right in the middle of the sequence while they're still sitting in the truck.
Yeah, and it's really funny because Wang's trying to educate Kurt a little bit on, like, you know, the history between these two groups. He's like, okay, he's like, this is the Chang Sing and this is the Wing Kong. And like, of course he can never keep it straight, you know, he's describing these, you know, two ancient Chinese warrior societies. And
no, and neither could I, to honest. And I'm like, I'm trying to follow this and the scene is happening. I'm like, am I going to have to know this for later? I don't think so. Like, my memories of this movie was like, all right, I don't need to know the whole history of this gang warfare that's going on now. But I was clinging to it. I was like, wait a minute, if this is going to be important later on, if there's going to be a quiz on this, I got to
know. That's another thing that makes this movie so much fun is that, like, it's a movie that you can watch in different modes. Like, you can watch this on a scale of 1 to 10, you could have your attention level at 5, and you're still going to love it.
Yep.
You know, there's nothing critical, but you can also watch this, like, attention level at 10, and you've got to take some notes. I mean, just all the mythology and all the different characters, and then you get the Three Storms come in here, which is absolutely... I remember that was, like, the first thing I thought when I saw this, because obviously... or just the way my life turned out, I played a lot of Mortal Kombat before I ever saw Big Trouble in Little China.
Oh, me too.
So, you know, when I was watching this movie, I'm like, oh my God, that's fucking Raiden.
Yeah.
I mean, it just is. You know, there's no, I don't think there's really any They just like shamelessly ripped off this, one of the Storms for that character. But yeah, this scene's great. And then we also get to see Lopan for the first time. And basically, Jack runs him over, but just kind of goes through him.
Yeah, this is the ghostly, kind of more imposing version of Lopan. We also see his other forms as the movie goes on, but he's pretty scary looking here. He's definitely an imposing figure.
Yeah, so, you know, this fighting continues, and they just kind of luckily, like, escape. But a chase ensues with some pretty cool scenes there. And I don't want to rush ahead, but this scene where Wang takes Jack back to the restaurant and they're just hanging out, and man, when Kurt Russell's on the phone with his insurance company,
hilarious.
And it is, that is, every time I just laugh so hard at everything he says.
Yep.
Don't give me any of that act of God crap either. I mean, it's just, it's so, so good. And this is where we're getting familiar with a little bit more of like the mysticism in the movie, and, you know, we're learning more about the magic and stuff like that. And obviously all of this is just way above his head.
Chris, forgive me. Is this the scene where Wang talks about the story of the demon and what happened 2,000 years ago? And he says, you know, that's just something that was passed down. It's something you tell the kids as a scary story or something like that. Is that here or is that later?
That is later in the movie. That is later when they both get captured.
Okay, because I love that bit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's great. He's like, I don't expect you to believe this. And, you know, but he's like, insists on telling him anyway.
I love sort of any movie that does something like this, right? Where we're oriented in the real world, and Jack Burton is a guy he's a trucker. He's kind of a rough and tumble blue collar guy. And that's what his life has been. And then you've got all these characters in Chinatown who basically are at least somewhat aware that there's magic and the supernatural. And, you know, it's almost like a Harry Potter kind of world. And they know that it exists, but nobody else does. And so it's like these outside are brought into that. It's really fun with Jack Burton too, because he doesn't really seem to give a shit all that much. Like, he's never sort of wowed by, you know, like magical things happen in front of him, and it's just like, oh well, I gotta fight my way out of here, you know, I got sandwiches to eat and stuff to deliver. So he's not sort of taken with it the way, you know, I would be so distracted by the fact that people are shooting lightning bolts out of their fingers and stuff like that.
Yeah, he is a little freaked out by how he ran over Lopan, though, because there's that one line where he's like, what the hell's going on? You know, I ran over this guy through or whatever, you know, I mean, he's just like, I think he's a little shocked. So, but yeah, I see what you're saying. He's just trying to like do his thing. And it's all of this crazy you know, stuff about sorcery and these ancient Chinese warrior societies, and he's just like trying to get his fucking truck back.
Yep.
You know. So they get together again with Gracie. We meet her journalist friend Margot, who's also an important character in this movie, and the magician Egg Shen.
Egg Shen,
who basically is in a lot of ways, he's kind of like the elder with all the knowledge sort of character. I don't know if I'm really describing that.
Oh yeah, he's totally best. Like a mentor figure. Victor Wong is just so much fun in this movie because he gets to do a little bit of the wise old mentor kind of character, but he gets to be funny also. And we meet him, he's a tour bus driver, the Egg Fu Yang tours that take these sort of gape-jawed white tourists through Chinatown, and he teaches them a little bit about Chinese immigrants' history in America. And I really like those scenes too, and the production design, that truck bus thing that he has is really great.
Yeah, and you'll be happy to know that he returns also along with Dennis Dunn in Prince of Darkness.
Really? He's great. I've looked him up. I knew he passed away a while ago. It was 2003, I think. So we lost him quite a ways ago. Although James Hong, who plays David Lopan, is still with us and still making movies, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically, I just think it's really cool how Victor Wong and Dennis Dunn, so they did two pictures in a row with Carpenter here, because Prince of Darkness is his next movie. We'll get there when we get there. God, I can't wait for you to see that.
Oh, me too.
So anyways, they go to this brothel.
So I got to tell you, this is one of my absolute favorite scenes in the movie. Maybe we'll stop here after this because I do want to talk about this, and then we'll get into the rest of the what happens in the film in the next episode. But that's Kurt Russell is so damn funny in this scene. He's wearing the suit from the movie Used Cars. We talked about that movie on our old show, Talking Movies. Comedy from 1980 by Robert Zemeckis, where he's this kind of wheeling-dealing car salesman guy and wears this great suit throughout that movie, and he brings it back here, and he's got these like wide glasses frames. He looks like Clark Kent a little bit. In fact, watching this sequence, I was like, wow, I wonder what would have happened if they cast Kurt Russell as Superman / Clark Kent at some point. He would have been great.
I don't want to interrupt, but I do want to point out Used Cars, very, very fun movie.
Love it.
Yeah, it's awesome. I actually have watched that again since we did the show on it, and I was like, this movie is just hilarious. That opening scene where he rigs the odometer in the car.
Oh, it's great.
Just right off the bat, I'm like slapping my knee, just like, this is awesome.
And ends with this incredible stunt sequence that's just like, you know, it's like out of something like a Fast and the Furious movie or something like that. Like, 80s comedies were really, they were pretty off the wall. I mean, even this one is a good example that, you know, comedy was such a more popular genre in theaters back then, so Hollywood would just throw so much money and do these really elaborate, amazing kinds of sequences. I mean, I guess it does go back to that Buster Keaton kind of tradition that we were talking about earlier, where comedy is about spectacle and you go big to get the big laughs. I don't know. It's a thesis for another day. But anyway, this scene is so funny. He's just like this schlubby guy who goes into a brothel and he's there to rescue Wang's fiance, Miao Li. But first, he has to like talk his way past the madam to get into a room with her. It's just so funny. Like, he's a great undercover kind of actor. Like, he does that sort of thing twice in this movie, where it's almost like a Fletch thing where he puts on a whole new persona, and it's just such a goofy, dorky persona, and he's obviously having so much fun with it.
It is the absolute best. I mean, and I love how he's kind of like, in particular, I'm looking for someone with green eyes. And it's just so funny.
He sounds so pervy, too. Like, obviously, I mean, yeah. you know what he's there for. You know what kind of business that is. I wouldn't have known that when I was a kid, when I first saw bits and pieces of this movie. But yeah, he's so skeevy. And I was reading about Kurt Russell. I guess he contracted the flu while he was shooting this movie. And he's sweating profusely in this scene because he was sick. So he's also just kind of like greasy and sweaty, and he's got this brown suit on. It's so funny.
Yeah, so he goes into the room with this girl and she makes a comment about his tie, and he's like, oh yeah, my wife got me that.
Yes.
Like, it's like so, so good.
It's so that caricature of like a businessman who's on a trip somewhere and, oh, I'm in San Francisco, I might as well sample the local prostitutes or whatever. Like, we've seen that in so many movies.
Yeah, yeah. Oh God! So basically, they're here and up and essentially the mission gets interrupted because we get the three storms come back and literally blow the roof off the place.
Yep.
And it's funny because that's another example of how Jack Burton's just standing there looking at it, you know, in amazement, like what the hell is going on?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't talked enough about the three storms yet. Like, these are mystical fighters who basically drop out of the sky and they have elemental powers, and they use them a lot. I mean, they use them a lot in public too. It's not just sort of, I mean, part of this movie does take place in an enclosed like compound, but until we get there, it's just like all hell is breaking loose. And the way the movie is sort of structured and the way the script works, it's almost like this stuff happens all the time in Chinatown, and you know, we as outsiders just don't get to see it. Like, it is kind of a magical world. And you know, maybe that goes back to Ebert's idea that it's sort of playing on these stereotypes of Chinese characters, but it almost establishes Chinatown as this place where just like anything can happen, and stuff like this just does happen, where, you know, it's a pretty regular occurrence where this ghostly 2,000-year-old emperor will show up out of nowhere and his warriors will drop out of the sky. It's kind of like the Mortal Kombat universe.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
This scene reminded me a little of Escape from New York, where Snake Plissken is, you know, the chock full of nuts sequence where he's going like from building to building.
Chock full of nuts. Yes, yes, absolutely. But the effects here are great too. And, you know, it's basically, I don't know, it's just all together a really fun scene. And I love how everyone else is kind of like waiting outside for Jack to go in and complete this mission. And it's like, I love how like he's their guy. You know what I mean? It's like, they're like, oh, he's going to pull this off. And like, you're just, at this point, you already know his character enough to know that like, yeah, he's kind of clumsy and, you know, whatever. But it just kind of adds to the comedy of the whole scene.
Yeah, like all he's really got going for him is he's a fast talker and he doesn't look like any of the rest of the people in this scene. So it's like they're not going to recognize him right away. He's a white guy. He's not from Chinatown. So that's really the skills that they're playing on there. And they definitely seem to have some trepidation about it. And they kind of know that he's probably going to fail and then maybe they can bust in and actually get the job done.
Right. And I should point out, just for a little bit of continuity here, the three storms come in here to kidnap Mai Yin. Is it Mai Yin?
It's Miao. They say Mao and then they also say Meow sometimes. And, saying Meow right. just kind of reminds me of Super Troopers. So I like it when they just call her Mao.
Right. Mao Yin, Miao Yin. Basically, the three storms come and capture her. They pull her out of the room through the roof to this place, and they're taking her back to Lo Pan. So basically, that's probably where we should cut it off, because the next scene is going to be when they infiltrate Lo Pan's lair, if you will.
Yeah, another fun bit of Kurt Russell going undercover as a different type of character. They're like repairmen. That's their really kind of stupid ruse to get into Lo Pan.
Too funny.
Export, import, export business.
Too funny. I love how they walk in and they're just like, oh yeah, I know what we're doing right over there. We got just like last time. And they just walk. I mean, it's great.
Yeah, it's really,
so
really
funny.
Fun. I mean, that's the thing. It's a very silly movie. It's a very over the top movie and it's all by design. It's not, I mean, it's meant to be sort of just pitched at this very tongue in cheek level. And we do get a sense of that really early on. So we're not expecting this to turn into an 80s action movie in the sense where, I mean, you know, like Lethal Weapon for part of its going is a comedy. And then there's like really brutal action sequences in that movie. You know, Mr. Joshua beating the shit out of somebody, you know, beating a guy within an inch of his life. And then these shootouts with like lots of squibs and lots of death and destruction. This is not that. It is, I mean, I almost think this would be a great kids movie. It maybe takes a few things a little farther than a kids movie should, but it is, you know, it's very cartoony in a lot of ways, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And almost has that sort of manic Looney Tunes sort of energy and just sort of a feeling that violence is not to be taken terribly seriously. And I think these couple of undercover scenes just really set that up really well for the rest of the going of the movie.
I could not be happier that you liked this movie. I do gotta say, though, man, I was pretty optimistic that you were going to be into this, especially this last time watching it. You know, I enjoyed it so much. I was just like, oh, Nick is going to love this. I knew you were going to love it.
Yeah, I mean, and I would actually say, I mean, I know I have my reservations about it, but I loved it. I enjoyed watching it so, so very much. And although I think there are ways that it might have been a better written movie and there's other things they could have done with it, I mean, I just had a really good time with it. And I think almost anyone who can kind of suspend their disbelief and just doesn't mind a sort of madcap rollicking adventure rather than something they're meant to take very seriously. I mean, this is kind of an old Hollywood serial, very much like where Spielberg was making Raiders of the Lost Ark. He was inspired by these serials where, you know, it's 15-minute sections and they're all action and they end on a cliffhanger and then we get like a whole other set of set pieces for the next episode. And he was just combining that all into one movie with Raiders. And this does that too. I mean, it's just sequence followed by crazier, bigger, more elaborate sequence followed by some sort of left turn kind of sequence that's also kind of pitched at that very manic sort of madcap level. So, I mean, I'd hate to meet the person who can't have a good time with this movie.
Yeah, and I can't believe I avoided it all those years. And then starting to get into John Carpenter and looking at his filmography and going, oh my God, he did Big Trouble, like this movie that a friend of mine always would tell me about. And I think he manages to pull off something incredibly unique here. But I also think that, you're probably appreciating it. I mean, as a standalone film, you'd probably love it just as much, but do you think you would love it just as much if you hadn't been going through this process, like watching all his films in order, kind of giving you a little bit more appreciation for him as an artist?
I mean, that's a really good question. That's a really, really good question, because it's not much like, I mean, my favorite Carpenter film is The Thing, right? And it is as far from that, aside from sharing a star with that movie and sort of Kurt Russell being an iconic character in that movie and R.J. McCready, this is really like nothing else that he's done up to, I mean, maybe Dark Star. Dark Star has some silliness and some sort of cartoonishness that's a little bit like this movie. There's a creature in this movie that we'll have to talk about next time that I think is a very direct homage to Dark Star. I'm not sure if it is, but it looked that way to me and felt that way to me.
Beach Ball.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's cool to see a director that I like kind of completely switch up his game. I mean, to do something like a martial arts comedy, particularly following up something like Starman, which was such a much more conventional movie. I mean, even though there's aliens in that, and even though it's a very fantastical story, the human relationships at the center of that movie, I was very moved by. And this is not a movie where you're supposed to be moved by the relationships. This is a movie where your eyes are just supposed to be bugging out at all the crazy shit that you're seeing from scene to scene. And I don't know. I mean, the other thought that I had just throughout this whole thing is Carpenter must have just been having a blast on the set of this movie.
Oh, yeah.
This looks like such a fun movie to make, and just seeing all the fight choreography play out in front of you and working with all these really fun actors, you know, Gerald Akamura and Victor Wong and people like that. I mean, it's just... like, I wish I could have been on this set. It must have been a blast. I'm sure it was very chaotic, like the movie itself, but it has an energy that I don't think we've really seen in Carpenter at all until this point, and that's something to really appreciate about it also. And this is him just kind of going guns blazing into, like I've been saying, you know, silent movie, slapstick Buster Keaton territory.
Love it. Love it so much. Well, we do have a significant amount to talk about on the next episode. But to keep things tight, we'll wrap this one up here.
Yeah, Chris, I can't wait to talk about the escalator. This movie has...
Oh, yeah.
It has an escalator that just throws me so much. It's kind of a silly thing to say, but we got to talk about that. So many different places to go. We haven't really even met most of the characters yet. We know them at this point, but because this movie goes so fast, we've had very little time to get to know them at this point, so... I certainly think we have enough for easily one more episode. We'll keep it to one, although I think we could do several. Any final thoughts on the first third or so, not even, of Big Trouble in Little China?
It's all in the reflexes.
It's all in the reflexes, exactly. So we'd love to know your thoughts on this movie and where you feel it fits into the whole Carpenter canon, and let us know how we're doing with it, what else you might like to hear. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can reach us via email at precinct13podcast@gmail.com. We're on Twitter at 13precinct. Facebook.com/13precinct is our Facebook page. And our website, where you can download all our episodes and subscribe to the show, is precinct13.simplecast.com. If you have some time, we'd really appreciate an iTunes review. Leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. We'd love to know how we are doing. That would help us out a lot. We'd love to hear back from people who are listening to the show, and we will be back in a couple weeks to finish up our discussion of Big Trouble in Little China. Be safe out there. Hope everyone is doing well. Hope Carpenter movies are helping you get through this strange time in all of our lives. I know, Chris, I've been really grateful to have these films and to have them to talk about during this time. How about you?
Absolutely. You mentioned Dark Star. I watched Dark Star just last week since we did the show, and I laughed my ass off. It was awesome.
It's perfect quarantine viewing, right? Like, it's about four characters who are quarantined in a spaceship and are not having the human contact that they should have, and how they're slowly starting to unravel from all that. And
it's so, you know, good.
The government is kind of not doing a great job in that movie, and there's a lot of uncertainty and chaos, and maybe we all just need to ride a surfboard into the sun at this point.
Didn't he tell us that story 4 years ago? No, I think it was 4 years ago. Oh.
It is really, it's starting to feel so like that. Good. So we will catch you in a couple weeks. Yep. Take care. Be safe.